The views, information, and opinions expressed are those of the featured guests and not those of IG Wealth Management.
I'm Manjeet Minhas, one of Canada's top entrepreneurs, and so excited for you to join us today. Through a wealth of women's stories, IG is carving out a space where women's voices are heard. If you're looking for insight and inspiration through powerful storytelling that will resonate with anyone looking for the answers to the questions that we as women ask ourselves, then this series is for you. Today, we're so lucky to have Camille Dundas join us as our guest. She began her career as a journalist, writing and producing news for top media networks such as CBC, CTV, and CP24, which 7 years into her career led her to become the co-founder and editor-in-chief of BuyBlacks.com, Canada's number one Black online magazine. Camille has also worked in the tech industry, not only as a solutions consultant at Hootsuite, but also the founding co-chair of Hootsuite's first Black Employee Resource Group, where she provided strategic counsel to the executive leadership team on anti-racism and EDI frameworks. Most recently, Camille is the principal educator at the IDEA Practice, a partnership with Dalhousie University, offering its first online micro-credential course in inclusive communications. An accomplished public speaker and corporate diversity, equity, and inclusion consultant, working with many companies such as Google, TD Bank, KPMG Financial, Hyundai, and many more. Camille is also named one of the top 100 accomplished Black women in Canada. Welcome to the podcast, Camille.
Thank you so much for having me.
I hope I got all that right, because in part, I wanted to talk about the way you introduce yourself in your bio online. You have such an amazing, inspiring, and humbling way of introducing your incredible journey. And I quote, "I've gone from intentionally failing half my classes in high school to being named one of the top 100 accomplished Black women in Canada."
Yes.
That's pretty remarkable. So talk to me a little bit about your journey, about your story. Tell us about your childhood, where you grew up, and how you became interested in journalism.
I've had an interesting crisscross of a upbringing, being born in Trinidad. And when I was four, we moved here to Canada, to Toronto. And we stayed here till I was 12. And then my dad, who is from St. Lucia, decided to move the whole family back to St. Lucia. So I went to live in St. Lucia from age 12. And then I stayed there until age 21, until I decided to return to Canada for university at the journalism program at Carleton University. So it was a really interesting double culture shock, where I can still remember like being 4 years old and coming to Canada and feeling that blast of winter in my face. and actually we landed in Montreal first. And so going into kindergarten and all the other children speaking French, was a huge culture shock. And then when I was 12, by the time I was 12, I was Canadianized and having to go to a Caribbean island. The culture is completely different. The school system is completely different. It's very strict. I attended a convent high school. So You're suddenly in uniform, and the whole place is run by nuns, and they are not having any of your bullshit. So, like, none of your 12-year-old attitude is gonna fly.
I have one of those at home. So yeah, I get it.
Yeah. In terms of my interest in journalism, when I was really young, I thought I would be a writer, like a novelist. I was always just interested in books. In terms of, I really used it as an escape. I was writing short stories from age 7 and 8 and being asked to read my stories in front of my older brother's class, much to his embarrassment. So it was a gift that even adults around me were pointing out. So I knew there was something kind of special that I had that I held on to.
Right.
And it was also, you know, my mom, she always wanted to be in radio. While she was at university at McGill, she got pregnant with my sister and never finished her degree. And I think she always had, you know, a tinge of regret. And she was always pushing me to get into journalism. She's like, "You're going to be like Christiane Amanpour. You can do this. You can be that." Many parents force their children into the vision that they have for them or what they feel like they should do. And so looking back, I didn't realize at the time, but now as an adult looking back, I'm so grateful that they both supported what I wanted to do. My dad, he was always in reading newspapers. And we developed sort of like a little ritual. On Saturday mornings, he would go and buy all the newspapers, about four or five. And he would sit on the chair, I'd sit on the floor, and I'd wait for him to go through the paper. And then he'd hand me like the funnies, little like comics from the back then. There were comics, yeah. Comic inserts in the newspaper, kids.
Yeah.
And you know how long I've been waiting to say back in my day?
Right.
But I remember one of those newspapers, the motto on it was, the pen is mightier than the sword. And in my mind, I was like, huh, that means that I have power. It means that I can make some type of change or impact with my words. And that's when I started realizing how important words were. Now, just so happens, the house that we grew up in was literally a stone's throw away from the one of two local television stations.
And that's in St. Lucia, right?
That's in St. Lucia, yeah. Yes. One summer, I was, 16 or 17 years old, and my friend and I, we used to watch this show on that station, which was kind of like like a music video show, right? And they would like interview local artists, but it was hosted by a guy who's a little bit older and uncool in our opinion, right? So we're like, we could do a much better job doing this. So we're like, let's write them a letter. So we did. And then they actually responded and said, okay, come host the show. So that summer, my friend and I hosted the show. I had zero experience, but just thrown right onto TV on camera. And I loved it. And the producer of that show was also the news producer. And one day he said, do you want to stay while we do the news? And I was in the control room and they turned down the lights. He started counting down and I had never been more excited. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is what I want to do. It was the most exciting thing ever to produce the news. And that's when I was like, you know what? It's going to be journalism for sure.
Gotcha. And that's the two part to journalism, right? Some people think of it as one or the other. But just going back there a little bit, you know, you definitely had a little bit of a unique story when it comes to immigrant families, no matter where they're from. When they are moving, especially to Canada, education is deemed important, but not necessarily the reading portion of things, books, because it seemed as, you know, sometimes a waste of time. And by a lot of people, my mom used to always think that, my dad the exact opposite. And my dad's mom, my grandmother always used to say, translated it, she used to say, a well-read woman is a dangerous creature. And I never really understood it because my dad always encouraged us to read, but I never understood it until I got older when I realized, like you now as an adult, that not everybody got that opportunity. Not everybody got that opportunity to have that time in order to just immerse themselves in stories and reading and language and other people's fiction or nonfiction characters, which is pretty fascinating because it does create, and in your case, not in mine, but in your case, definitely a career path. And so you definitely talk about an incredible story that I've heard you talk about, which was about a journalism professor when you landed your first real job in Canada. And he said to you, you're more than a program. Show up and show them. Can you share this story a little bit for us? Because that pep talk, I think, is so important because not a lot of people have that. And when you're young, even when you're older, definitely there is some naivety. There is some, let me say yes to these opportunities. But we often, you know, have imposter syndrome or confidence issues, as women especially, to actually do something out of our box. And so how did that pep talk and how did that allyship really help support you?
It was a difficult time for me. I was straight out of, just graduated journalism school. And my prof came to me and said, hey, there's this opportunity at the CBC to do a one-year program where you do half 6 months in radio and 6 months in television. I was like, awesome. And I understood that they came and chose like the top two performers from the class. So I was like, that's awesome. I made it. And I had no idea that this was a diversity program.
Ah.
And so I went in and it was really good at first. And then I started noticing little things that I couldn't quite explain. things like people mentioning, oh, you're here because of the program. You're here on that program, right? And I was like, yeah, I guess, mm-hmm. right? Or me sort of pitching stories and my stories being taken and given to a young white male intern. Or cameramen telling me, you know, you shouldn't wear this color. This color is not right for your skin tone. Meanwhile, they just didn't understand how to light someone of my complexion.
Right.
Lots of just little things.
Microaggressions.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And I found out accidentally that I was on this program just through going to a training session, traveling there and being sat next to one of the producers who was organizing it and just making small talk and saying, oh, like who else is going to be at the training? And she had a binder with all of our names on it. She's like, oh, let me sift through. And she was looking down at the list of names. And I saw this acronym next to my name, but I was too embarrassed to ask her what it meant. And so when I went back, I got to the hotel and I went on the company's intranet and searched it and then realized what the acronym meant. And I just felt gutted because I started questioning everything.
Right.
I started questioning, whoa, am I as good as I thought? Did I really make it here on my own merit? I know I'm the only Black student in my entire graduating class. Is that the reason that I'm here? And so I got very down about it. And I felt defeated. I felt like there was nothing I could do. Mm-hmm. Knowing also full well at the time that I was feeling something that I didn't have the language to assert in terms of the hiding that I was doing of my own identity. Being in rooms, meeting rooms where, again, you're the only Black person and stories are being discussed in a way that feels uncomfortable to you, but you don't quite know how to address it. And furthermore, you're scared to address it. And so I went to that lecturer who happened to also work there. He was the only Black lecturer I've ever had. And I went up and I talked to him and I told him what I found out. And he just literally held me by the shoulders. And he was like, so?
Right.
You might have gotten here because of this program. This may have been your foot in the door, but that is mm-hmm. not the reason you are here.
Right.
So wipe those tears. Show up and show out. Go back down to the newsroom. It was important for me to even have someone to talk to about it. And I would like to tell you that that pep talk completely changed my life and got me going. But honestly, it didn't. It took me years to regain my confidence, years to feel that I belonged in a national television newsroom. It's done.
Yeah, I think that's very honest of you to say that it's not always one thing that turns. It wasn't this, oh my God, that changed my life, that pep talk. But it does show that there was allyship, that there was somebody that you could talk to. And not everybody has that. And when mm-hmm. there is, whoever that might be, whatever their age, their gender, and their background, that you did have somebody, because not everybody has somebody to actually say, yeah, go get them. Talk about that. Let's talk about allyship because, you know, you educate that allyship is not a destination, but a constant daily journey of understanding and showing up in solidarity with colleagues from underrepresented groups. So what do you think allyship looks like?
It really begins with deep self-reflection. And I say that's important because if you don't understand or if you are not able to pinpoint where your privileges lay in any given situation, it will be very difficult for you to practice allyship. And I say in any given situation because our levels of influence and privilege shifts based on what room we're in.
True.
Based on who is in the majority and who is not. And so if you walk into a room and you're able to scan that room and say, okay, I'm in the majority here, the majority who has power. So today, maybe I'm going to step back a little bit. maybe I'm going to say, Manjeet, I'd love to know what you think if I realize that Manjeet is not speaking today.
Right.
Or if she's being spoken over.
Hmm.
So sometimes allyship doesn't look like stepping up. It looks like stepping back
mm-hmm.
and inviting others to the table. It's also a real understanding of the historical context of what oppression looks like. And I say this first to especially leaders that I work with, because they're always wondering about the right thing to say.
Right.
And they'll say, Camille, what do I say when this happens? Or how do I address this? And I said, okay, I can help you with that. And I explained to you. But if you truly want to have an authentic allyship journey, you will never know what to say if you don't understand why we are still facing issues of inequality today. To understand those, you have to understand the historical context of these things. And if we are in Canada, particularly the Canadian context of different types of inequality. And so when you do understand these things, then suddenly the microaggressions that people speak of, it doesn't seem trivial to you anymore. You're like, ah, I get that. Because now I know this. I understand this part. I understand how you may have been carrying this burden for generations in your family. And this is something you've had to stay silent about. And every time someone shortens your name or renames you, it's just another strike.
Right.
It's another little like a paper cut, right? That you just store in your soul and eventually just keeps breaking you down. You'll understand these things and it won't be so burdensome for both parties. It's right. burdensome for the aspiring ally because they're struggling to understand, why are you so upset about this? It's burdensome for the person experiencing it because they're like, I can't believe I have to explain this to you. And I've had to explain this dozens of times. And here I am again, trying to explain this to you and you don't get it.
Hmm.
So taking the time to understand where your own biases are, where your levels of privilege are in any given room, and taking the time to understand the historical context will set you miles and miles further on your allyship journey.
Yeah, it's a great point. It's a great point that when, you know, people say, how do I be a good ally? And often that simply means not just making yourself comfortable, right? I think that it's not our differences always that divide us. It's our inability to recognize, accept, and celebrate the differences and sometimes speak about them and sometimes then say, apologize, but also understand and take a moment to say, okay, such as you mentioned, a simple thing that it might be harder for me to pronounce your name properly, but that shouldn't be on you. That should be on me in order to try to pronounce it, to ask you if I need to multiple times, if I need to write it in different ways, ask you the meaning, like whatever it might be, but not try to make life easy for me and make it harder for you. And exactly. I think that sometimes is hard for people to understand and accept. And so why is solidarity with colleagues from underrepresented groups so important to you? And what does solidarity look like to you? Because that is a word that is, I think, used in a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm. Solidarity is the next step from allyship, to allyship rather, because it really now requires you to take a risk or to yield the floor, to yield some of your power that you're accustomed to. And when I talk about power, I mean just, I'm talking about things that you probably have taken for granted. And that is like the power that you have to be automatically believed in most situations or to be automatically trusted when you show up in any situation. And I'll give you an example of that so that it's tangible. I have a very good friend, a white woman, who's a very good friend of mine who I ended up working with at the same company with. And during COVID, we all were home, of course, and I wanted to get my chair from the office. And it couldn't fit in my car, but it could fit in hers. Now, we're both married to Black men, right? So her apartment is near the office. And we were over babysitting her kids. And I said, hey, you know what? Since you're going downtown and the chair can fit in your car, how about you go and get the chair for me? She's like, yeah, for sure. She's like, I'll just use my swipe card, whatever. And both of our husbands immediately were like, that's a bad idea. because she would basically technically be impersonating me, because it's to go and get stuff from somebody's workstation should be that same person, right? And she's like, guys, it'll be fine. Trust me. And we both had a chuckle, unspoken between us. We both knew because she was a woman and she was white that she would be trusted. Mm-hmm. That if one of our husbands, or even if I went there and they asked for my ID or whatever, if I was trying to get something from her desk, it wouldn't work the same way. And our husbands were visibly nervous. They were like, you guys shouldn't do this. We're like, it's cool. She goes down to the building, literally walks through the security. Not only doesn't ask her for ID, doesn't ask her for her swipe card, helps her go up the elevator, brings the chair down for her and puts it in the car for her. And it was, a laughable but very real life example of how we, in different bodies, we get treated differently, right? And so someone like her is aware of that privilege, and they're aware of when they can leverage it. Right. They're aware of when they can use it or when they can point it out, right? When they can say, wait a minute, this isn't right. If she's in a situation, I'm a Black woman, but I'm also a light-skinned Black woman.
Yes.
And so I've had to do the uncomfortable self-reflection to think back on all the times I've been treated differently than a dark-skinned Black woman. And I've just ignored it or haven't said anything.
Yeah.
Because when we're talking about race and racism, a dark-skinned Black woman, statistically and also interpersonally, gets treated much differently than me. And that's an experience I cannot speak to.
Right, right. And I like that you bring it back on yourself, just because everybody then assumes like, oh, since you are, I'm using air quotes, expert in this field, that you don't have any of these issues either. But you do too. And it goes to show that everybody does. Everybody has some advantages, some privilege in particular rooms, like you say, based on a variety of different things. It can be their family, their parents, like you said.
Where you went to school.
The body they're in, where you went to school, your accent, you're not.
Yes.
And so nobody fits, and you've said this, into one single category. And we're influenced by our socialization experiences, culture, and background. So let's talk about intersectionality a little bit. What does it mean and why is it important?
Intersectionality simply refers to all of the different parts of our identity. They intersect in different ways, meaning they have different outcomes and consequences for different people. So if I am of several marginalized, and I'm using air quotes, identities, my outcomes can be a lot worse than someone else who doesn't have intersecting identities. So in real terms, if I'm Black, if I'm queer, if I'm poor, if I'm uneducated, quote unquote, formally educated. All of these things will intersect to make my experience a little bit tougher. And that's important for us to understand when we're looking at workplace policies, when we're looking at how we hire people, when we're looking at where we recruit from, right? And the way that that has played out in my life, my experience, is working in the corporate world and working for companies that profess to, quote unquote, put women first. Our entire diversity strategy is about gender diversity and balancing the gender gap, the gender pay gap, for example. In fact, the gender wage gap is a perfect example of this. Because very often when we see studies or think pieces that are talking about, oh, women are making these great advances in the workplace, the wage gap is closing. When I look into these studies and I start to sort of peel back the onion, I realize that a lot of these statistics are made up of white women. And so when they're talking about the success of women or the advances of women, we're leaving out, we haven't counted Black women Asian women, South Asian women, Indigenous women, women with disabilities, immigrant women, and I can go on and on. If we then, and this is now just mathematically and statistically speaking, if we were then to account for all of these groups, the outcomes look a lot different. Mm-hmm. But because for us, for many of us, when we think woman, we actually think white woman.
Yes.
And that's our bar. That's our measuring stick. And so when I'm invited, for example, to speak on a Women's Day panel, and I'm the only Black person, no problem. But when we start talking about experiences as a woman, and I start to speak about the specific or unique ways in which I am discriminated against, not just because I'm a woman, but because I'm a Black woman, everybody gets very uncomfortable. Because, oh, we're here to talk about gender. But I cannot talk about gender without talking about my race.
Right.
Because these two things intersect for me. I cannot separate them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that is unique to everybody, but it is something that is also equal to everybody, and that everybody has, they don't fit into a single category.
Everybody has these intersections. And it's always so telling. I do this exercise in my sessions where I ask people to fill in the blanks of some questions. Questions like, what is the part of my identity that I feel the strongest, that I'm most aware of? What is the part of my identity that I'm least aware of? Mm. It's also very telling how two women of the same race, the same ethnicity, can say, I feel my gender is what I feel most aware of. But then the other woman will say, it's the one I feel least aware of. We all have these different experiences, right? Yeah. And so that's really what, what intersectionality underscores. These things will intersect differently and have like different outcomes for people based on their experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had a mentor who said something to me and I laugh, but it means so much when you think about it. And she always used to say that equal rights for others does not mean less rights for you.
Yes.
It's not pie. Mm-hmm. Say, yes, it's not pie. You are right. But it's a way to think of it in the fact that exactly like you're saying, they're not just words, that there's lots of meanings toward it. And equality is not just for a particular type of person.
100%. Neither is allyship, because no matter your identity, you will need an ally at some point. And that's really important for everyone to think about, especially those of us who feel like we don't have a place in this diversity conversation. We will all need an ally at some point. So it makes sense for us to understand what that looks like and how to practice it.
And so this kind of goes on the next topic I want to touch, which is your determination to support and educate others. Let's talk about the industries and their decisions related to diversity, equity, and inclusion, and how their decisions matter. So in your bio, you write, statistics show that industries across the board could make serious gains in revenue per year through diversity, inclusion, and belonging efforts. But despite throwing millions of well-intentioned dollars at DEI programs, underrepresented groups struggle to get their foot in the door. And when they do, they almost never make it up in the ranks. Something doesn't add up. Can you expand on this a bit?
I have seen many companies pat themselves on the back for their diversity efforts. And if I was to draw an org chart of their company, all of their so-called diversity would be at the bottom of that org chart.
Yep.
And so it's very easy to reward ourselves for this type of work, when in fact, the meaningful positions, all positions are meaningful, but meaningful change in terms of having diversity in positions of power is ignored. And so we are just whizzing by the insidious biases and processes that prevent people of diverse backgrounds from moving up the ranks, so to say, in companies. And when I say insidious, it's these passing comments like, they're just not a good culture fit. Hmm. Or I just don't get boss vibes from them. Would you want to have a beer with that guy? She's got sharp elbows. Hmm. Or, you know what? She has really young kids.
Hmm.
Right? These are all things I'm sure you and I have overheard.
Absolutely.
Time and time again. And these are acceptable things to say. These aren't shock and awe comments that are going to get you fired, right? But these are the things that have real life outcomes for people. So we spend a lot of money, or we are capable of spending a lot of money on creating ERGs and all these things that we can show off, right? Mm-hmm. But then when I go to the ERGs, they're telling me, oh, they have a $2,000 budget annually. What do you do with that? Or they don't have a direct line to the CEO.
Right.
Or they are micromanaged by HR or wherever else, right? Meaningful work. And you mentioned discomfort. It really requires a level of discomfort for those of us who are accustomed to having all the power, having things be decided in a way that makes us very comfortable.
And so, what is your outlook on DEI in the Canadian business landscape? What do you think are the most important step to making Canadian workplaces more equitable for everybody?
I think there needs to be some levels of accountability. But before we even get to accountability, I will be very transparent with you in that the education that needs to happen is still at the rudimentary phase. Hmm. I think because of the flurry of activity after the murder of George Floyd, fast forward 3 years now, there may be a feeling that, oh, we've done so much, we've come so far. Yeah. But the engagements that I'm having have illustrated that we are still at step one. There are still so many nuances that we have not grasped, that people are still struggling to understand why we're even having these conversations in Canada. Hmm. Is this really a problem in Canada? And so for me, it always must start with education, because I cannot go in to a company and start advising you on how to change this policy and that policy and make these benefits more equitable and make your hiring and your recruiting, all of these pieces. There's so many pieces, of course, as you know, without you and your team understanding why this is even necessary. Mm-hmm. So for me, it still begins with education.
It's a good point. And unfortunately, 3 years later and or in 2023, we're still wondering, in some companies are still wondering why this is necessary, despite studies, reports, conversations, books, articles, like, you know, podcasts, the whole thing, that if you really wanted to listen, be educated and understand, there's a lot of resources out there, but it isn't being taken advantage of. Let's talk about you being an entrepreneur. And so you said in an interview that it was only when you were forced in 2008, when there were no jobs, that you got entrepreneurial, a consulting agency and a media consulting company. So what was that like for you? And to have that moment of awareness when you told yourself, yes, I'm a business person. And how did that feel?
It was actually terrible for the first long years, mainly because I did not come from an entrepreneurial family. We were a traditional, you got to go to university, get a degree, get a good job. And I never thought of myself as someone who had the skills to be a business person, to own a business. And yes, it was in 2008 during our Great Recession, when everyone got laid off. And I saw an opportunity, though. I was working as an intern, an unpaid intern at City TV. And there, at that time, there were huge protests happening in Toronto within the Sri Lankan community. They were doing big protests, like taking over the Gardiner Highway. And it was a big controversy in the city because people were saying, okay, fine, protest, but don't block our highway. We don't want that. And they were having difficulty getting the media to even listen to them. And I remember hearing producers around me kind of speak derogatory about that community. And I thought to myself, well, how are they supposed to know how to pitch their story to you or how to write the press release in a way that, you know, that makes sense for you? Or how are they supposed to know that it's better to have a press conference at 9 a.m. rather than at 2 p.m.? Or like, how do they know that if you actually don't tell them that or if someone doesn't advise them of that? And I literally called the organizers of one of the activist groups and I said, hey, I'm a producer, but I'm also a consultant. And here's what I've noticed are some of the issues from this side of the pond, right? Mm. Like this is how media people are seeing it. Right. And here are some things you can do differently. And they hired me to do two media training sessions for them. So I brought a camera person. I got them to practice speaking about their issues. Like, what are your core points? What are your core messages? These are the things that you're going to talk about. Here's how to speak in sound bites. Here's how to, like, all of these things that made them more media savvy. And that was my first business. I tell you, it was horrible because I got my friend to help me build a website and I was so proud of it. And then I sent it to all my siblings and they're like, yeah, this doesn't look good. This kind of sucks.
God bless their wings, eh?
Right. And it was my first kind of entry into like when you think something is so good and then the audience is like, that does not look good. And so it was my first foray into not taking things personal, into like, you know, yes, your business is you are your business, but having to like separate these things, very difficult for a 20 something year old at that time. And then going into, I closed this deal over the phone. They didn't know what I looked like. They didn't know how old I was. And when I showed up to the session, I remember the gentleman who opened the door. He's like, oh, you're so young. And then I was like, is that really what you meant to say? But okay, let's go with this. And so it's like facing those doubts, you know, of people seeing a young Black woman, does she really know what she's talking about? Yeah. And having to compensate for that or try to ignore that or not let that impact your work. So that was difficult, but I leaned into my community. I loved being able to have events. I had an event called The Big Pitch where I got authors, entrepreneurs, people who would want to pitch their stories but had difficulty understanding how to do so. By that time now, I was working in mainstream media. So I got my producer friends to come on a panel and to have people pitch to them and say, here's why I would click that over to my trash. Here's why I would want to produce that story. Here's why I would pitch that story in the morning meeting and give them guidance in real time. And then just to be able to have that FaceTime with actual media people is impossible. Yes. You can't just call up a producer. You can't just, so to create that opportunity was very rewarding for me to be able to do that. So I really enjoyed doing that.
Good to know it was a journey.
Yes. For sure.
So with buyblacks.com, you're the co-founder and editor-in-chief. So just listeners know that the content shared on the website, it covers life, like pretty much everything, entertainment, fashion, food, legal, marketing advice, health, technology, travel. Like, so why was it important for you to have so much topical diversity on this site?
It was important because we needed to show that the Black community has range, that we're not just here to be linked to crime or to these negative statistics that often surround us. It is to reinforce Black success, that we have a business directory where you can find Black doctors and dentists and lawyers and creative people, writers and dancers and all kinds of different people. And so we have an expert column where we have a lawyer who talks about legal issues, gives legal guidance on different issues. We have an accountant, a financial person, a fitness person, parenting, all of these different things. Because having a front row seat in mainstream media allowed me to see the ways that we are portrayed in mainstream media. And there's a lot of exceptionalism happening. So it's either the way that you're experiencing Blackness in mainstream media is either criminality, mm-hmm. or this huge success. You're Jay-Z, you're Oprah.
Right.
And there's a huge middle piece, though, that doesn't get covered. And my husband and I were like, this is not our life experience. Right. Like we know so many cool people opening businesses, running a charities or opportunities for young people, giving back to their communities, doing all these cool things. And we don't see them on TV. Why?
Yeah.
So we wanted to create that space where that could be not only reflected back to our community, but also stand as an example of the diversity that exists just in our within our own community.
And so that explains why you do a lot of coverage of entrepreneurs, which I think is pretty fantastic, and celebrates entrepreneurs because you share a path to success. And I don't think necessarily the success part is covered as much by the media of the BIPOC entrepreneurs, more of the struggles. And like you say, there's the extremes then, right? It's either they're criminals and murderers or they're Beyonce and Oprah, if they're, you know, women in particular. And so why was it important to you not just to cover the struggles also? Because, you know, I think a lot of media is now focusing a little bit more on the struggles and the challenges more than they talk about the success. And so why is it important to you to focus on the success?
Because representation really does matter. To be able to see someone succeeding in a field that you didn't think was for you makes a big difference in your choices. I remember when I was still working at Hootsuite, I was able to work with a local group that was linked to MLSE, Maple Leaf Sports Entertainment. They had this great youth group, right? Of I think it was maybe 12 Black young girls and then 12 young Black men. And I brought them in just for a tour of the Hootsuite office. And then we sat in one of the meeting rooms and I got one of our lead recruiters to talk to them about LinkedIn, about their resume, about what you need to put on a resume, that type of thing. Simple stuff. But one thing I overheard while we were walking through the office to the room, right? At Hootsuite Toronto, we had a lot of diversity, visible diversity in our office. And one of the girls said, damn, Black people work here? And she was like, oh, I thought this was for white boys in hoodies. Because when they hear tech, that's what they think.
Right.
And so until that moment, she could not imagine or envision herself in a role like this. If not for that opportunity of just being able to walk through a tech office and just visualize what that looks like and feels like, maybe that will help her one day to when she's looking at her college options or university options to say, actually, yeah, I want to be a programmer.
Right.
Yeah, because I can do that. Why not?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that is not only meaningful, but it's powerful because it makes change not only for today, but for generations to come.
Absolutely.
Camille, it has been such a pleasure chatting with you today. I usually ask my guests what advice you would give women entrepreneurs, but reading about you, I became aware that you have a great perspective on advice versus needing action. So talk about this idea of action instead of advice.
I used to give a lot of advice. Mm-hmm. And now when people ask me about giving advice, I lean away from that. Mainly because what worked or what works for me may not necessarily work for you, because the combination of challenges and privilege that I am afforded because of different parts of my identity allow me to go onto certain paths. And so for me to tell you, oh, well, here's what to do. Here's what you should do in this situation. Doesn't work because we may not share those same levels of privilege. And so it's not fair and I think especially for women in the workplace, we have to be very transparent with younger women when they ask us for advice. And when I say that, I mean, for example, when we say to women, speak up, report this, do this, make sure, don't let anyone take advantage of you. Yes, fantastic. However, be honest with yourself. When did you start speaking up? When did you start taking risks to speak up in your career? I know for me, it wasn't straight out the gate. I know it was at least 7 years in when I felt comfortable to push back when I heard a racist comment, when I heard a sexist comment. So it's really inauthentic for me to say to a younger woman, oh, this is what you need to do. Instead, when I am asked for advice on any particular topic, the first thing I ask them is, what do you have to lose? And what are you willing to lose by taking action on this? And I'm not going to tell you to put your job at risk, your first job, your second job. I'm going to tell you, you alone will know what your boundaries are. And that is the most important advice I can give, is for you to know where your boundaries are. When someone crosses it, what does that trigger in you? And what action will you take?
Yeah, that's really important. I agree with you. Advice, it definitely can be empty when it is not only given in the masses, but also you don't understand every individual's life, their experience, where they are right now, personally, professionally, financially, a lot of different definitely factors in giving advice for sure. And I do think people should be careful.
That really hit home for me after experiencing the lean-in phenomenon, because I felt so left out of that conversation and so unseen by that conversation. And I couldn't understand why at the time. I was like, why can't I get with this? Why can't I get on board with this? Until I realized that there was so many assumptions being made by that advice. Number one, assumptions being made that we haven't tried to lean in and been smacked on the head. That it is a much different experience when a racialized woman speaks up than when a white woman speaks up. Not only are we both facing sexism, but I'm facing the additional racism that comes in when I'm looked at as the angry black chick, as the, you know, all of these different things that get layered on to my attitude that then impact my review and my pay and my possibilities of promotion. It isn't that easy to simply lean in when you have all these marginalized intersections of your identity working against you sometimes, to be honest.
Very true. It's nice to know somebody else didn't like that lean-in conversation. I actually have never said that out loud. So yeah, but you put it into words much better than I ever did, but you don't, I think there's probably a lot of people that didn't understand why it didn't speak to them while everybody was ranting and raving about it. But that is exactly why it didn't. Thank you so much, Camille, for this really insightful conversation. And thanks to everyone for listening and tuning in. I encourage you to find the wealth in your own stories. And remember, we don't need advice. We need action. Discover more inspiring conversations on past episodes of A Wealth of Women's Stories presented by IG Wealth Management. You can learn more by visiting ig.ca/women. And you can also find that link in the description of this episode. Cheers.
This has been A Wealth of Women's Stories, hosted by Manjeet Minhas and presented by IG Wealth Management. The views, information, and opinions expressed are those of the featured guests and not those of IG Wealth Management.